Part 14, The Indian Parable. Recall that the Khazar king had stated that he had a problem with the rabbi's initial introduction to Judaism. The rabbi had said that the basis of our faith is those specific events and miracles that our ancestors experienced. Those events, which were unique to the Jewish people only, are why we observe our faith to this day. The Khazar king said that that's completely unsatisfactory, since he was hoping to hear about a universal God who created heaven and earth, not about a God who only did good things for one small group of humanity. The rabbi responds now with a parable to explain why those specific experiences of our ancestors and their personal interaction with the God of miracles is not only what we believe, but it's actually the basis of our faith. And the rabbi answers this by providing a parable known as the Parable of the Indian King, or the Indian Parable. And the parable starts on page 68 with paragraph 19, where the rabbi says, let's say you were told that there is a king of India, and people claim to you that the king of India is benevolent and he's worthy of praise and honor. The proof of this is in the fact that the subjects of his kingdom are all righteous, kind, and upstanding. Is this enough of evidence for you to believe that the king of India is the reason for this kind of righteousness within the kingdom? So the Khuzari responds and he says, no, not necessarily. Who can tell? Maybe the Indians are righteous without a king at all. Maybe they are righteous because of their king, or maybe it's not because of their king, or maybe it's a combination of inherent righteousness and the influence of the king. So there's no way to prove that the king is righteous based upon the way that his subjects behave. So then the rabbi says, okay, fine, but let's say you have messengers that come from India, and you have irrefutable evidence that these people come from India because they bear the royal seal of the king with a letter with the king's handwriting. Together with this entourage, they bring with them medicines that can cure you of all of your sicknesses. They also provide you with very sophisticated weaponry that you can use against your enemies and defeat them on the battlefront. And so basically the king has presented you with these amazing gifts. Would you then not feel obligated to divert your attention and pledge your allegiance to this king and to pledge your fealty to him? So at this point the Khuzari says, well, of course, my initial doubt as to whether or not the Indians even have a king would be removed, and I would also believe that this king and his interests are of benefit to me. So then the rabbi says, well, if that's the case, if someone would ask you your opinion about the king based upon your experiences, what would you say? The Khuzari responds and he says, well, I would start by praising the king based upon what I had experienced as far as the king being very benevolent and kind and very giving, a very giving kind of soul. And then I would extrapolate and say, well, based upon these gifts that I've received and the letter that the king gave me, there must be additional things about the king that are praiseworthy. And this is where the rabbi says, okay, that's exactly what I was trying to respond to you when you first made your inquiry. And here the rabbi explains that the king of India is none other than Hashem himself in this parable. The messengers of the king that come bearing gifts, this refers to Moshe Rabbeinu, who brought down a set of tablets with the Ten Commandments that proved to the nation surrounding Mount Sinai that God had communicated with them. And these tablets, this Torah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us, is a very, very powerful tool that we can use against our enemies and we can use to heal ourselves with, because the spiritual information and instruction that is contained within the Torah is, of course, very, very powerful. As the Torah itself records it, if you hearken unto my commandments, then God says, I will protect you from all of your enemies and I will provide you with tremendous blessing. According to some of the commentaries, in this analogy, the messengers also refer to the patriarchs who had communications from Hashem, where it was quite clear to both them and those who knew them that they were receiving communications from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As a matter of fact, the concept that the Indian king provides weapons that can destroy your enemies may even be a reference to a midrash which states that our first Jew, our first patriarch, Avraham Avinu, was given special dirt. It was a miraculous kind of dirt that when he went out to wage battle with the four kings, as detailed in Genesis chapter 14, he was able to use this dirt by hurling it at his enemies, and it miraculously in mid-air would turn into arrows and swords and spears and kill the enemy. But in any event, it clearly refers to some kind of identifiable object of substance that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent to us via his messengers. The point is that the basis of our faith, the reason why we believe in God and the God of the Jewish people and the God of the Torah, is not because he created the world. As we mentioned before, there was no one around at the time to witness it. Rather, the point is that we experienced HaKadosh Baruch Hu personally. We as the Jewish people had a personal interaction with God. Those of us who are their descendants, says Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, also have a personal kind of connection to that experience. As he writes at the end of paragraph 25, we have passed down this account without interruption from generation to generation. And so even today, it is as if we are eyewitnesses to that event that occurred at Mount Sinai when we received these very tangible commandments inscribed on the tablets. And this, of course, leads the Kuzari to make a startling conclusion. At least for him, it's quite startling. And he says in paragraph 26, if this is so, it would seem that your Torah was given only to you Jews and that no one else is bound by it. And the rabbi acknowledges, of course that's true. The Torah is only for the Jewish people. And of course it must be that way, since the basis of our receiving the Torah is an historical event that occurred only for the Jewish people in the desert. It was given to us in our own language. It was not given in some universal kind of language. God revealed himself to our ancestors and chose us specifically out of all the other nations of the world. And this is where the rabbi makes it very clear that Judaism was never meant to be the religion for all mankind. It was always meant to be for only one small subset of humanity, since the task assigned to us is a special one. Our task is to be a Mamleches Kohanim Vigoy Kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation that is segregated and differentiated from the rest of the world. And we are therefore meant to serve God in a special way, and also we are there for the rest of humanity to act as an example, as will become clear later on in the Kuzari. Now this also effectively answers the question that the Kuzari king had presented before, not so much as a question, but actually as a statement. He had said before that there's really no point in my going to seek out proper religious activity by asking a Jew. You know why there's no point in asking a Jew? Because look at the world around me today. It's divided among Christians and Muslims and a small group of secular philosophers. But the Jews, they're a scattered nation, they're a dispersed nation, and they're so small in number. If there was any truth to Judaism, then the world would have picked up on it and the majority of the world would be Jewish today. However, what the king is neglecting to realize is that Jews don't proselytize. That's not part of our core theology, that the rest of the world has to become Jewish. If anything, we prefer to keep ourselves small, as the Torah states, Lo meru bechem mikol ha'amim. It is not because you are the greatest in number of all the nations that God has chosen you, ki atem hame'at mikol ha'amim, because you are actually the smallest of all nations. One can identify the reason as to why Christianity and Islam are so popular is because throughout history, Christians and Muslims have proselytized, many times through words and many times through the sword. And this was also a form of national identity, that when an empire sought to become unified and consolidated under one banner, many times the banner that was chosen was a banner of religion. So therefore the Roman Empire chose Christianity as its method of unifying all of its city-states and all of its conquests, and the Holy Islamic Empire chose the religion of Islam to unify and consolidate all of its conquests. Judaism never had the objective of conquest of land masses and of other countries, and it is for that reason that Judaism remains to this day the smallest of the nations. Now, after all has been said, there must be something within Judaism that is of appeal to the Khazar king, because if Judaism is only for the Jews, then the conversation should be over, and the Khazar king should say, well, if this is just for you Jews, you obviously have nothing to offer me. And that's where the rabbi comes in paragraph 27, and he says, you are right, but non-Jews who wish to adhere to the Torah will share in the rewards like us, just not to the same degree. If the requirement to follow the Torah were based on the fact that God created us, then all people, white and black alike, would be obliged to follow it. Rather, we Jews are obliged to follow the Torah because God took us out of Egypt and attached his glory to us. And Hashem did this specifically for us, as we are the choicest of all mankind. Now, before we get to the controversial statement of the Jews being the choicest of all mankind, we really do need to stop for a moment and recognize that the first part of the statement, that non-Jews who wish to adhere to the Torah will share in the rewards like us, though not to the same degree, is equally revolutionary. As a matter of fact, it's arguably even more revolutionary when we compare Judaism to the other monotheistic faiths. Unlike Christianity and Islam, which say that if a person is not a Christian or not a Muslim respectively, they are guaranteed eternal damnation, Judaism, however, openly professes that while the Torah was only given to the Jewish people, the objective is not to convert the whole world to Judaism, and therefore, as a result, other human beings can reach spiritual greatness by being righteous non-Jews, by being righteous Gentiles. And you can attain a portion in the world to come. You can attain spiritual greatness, and you don't have to be a Jew. Now, can a Jew potentially achieve spiritual greatness that surpasses the spiritual greatness of a non-Jew? Yes. We have 613 commandments. Non-Jews have 7 Noahide commandments. But let's not forget about the truly remarkable fact that non-Jews can achieve spiritual greatness and a portion in the world to come, even if they don't convert to Judaism. The only dark side, if you will, is that Judaism, at least according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, still maintains that the Jewish people are the elite or choicest of all mankind, and this is something that needs to be explained very carefully in our next talk.